It's 8:35 right here in the Boulder studio of KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. Again, it is Bike to Work Day. We are on the downside of that. So come by and get some breakfast while you still can. I sent my interns, the wonderful newsroom interns, out there this morning with a recorder. Poor Jaejeong Kit met a girl with a cat in her bag.
There's a pet in the bag.
It's so cute.
Angel.
My name is Mars Parker Stone. I have a special backpack that carries around cats, like my cat Angel. My cat is around 85 in cat years, 16 in human years, and she's cute.
She is very cute. Do you know if she's enjoying the ride?
Sometimes she might be freaked out, but sometimes when we're just sitting down or something, she would just be pretty calm.
What brought you to our station today?
For Bike to Work Day. I got some stickers from last Bike to Work Day. What I really like about Bike to Work Day, you get to visit other places and get a good exercise on your bike. There's a lot of food and drinks.
I wanted to state that carrying a cat around in a backpack was 100% not Dad's idea.
Well, cats, kids, dads, moms, everybody's here for Bike to Work Day at KGNU. Thank you to our interns for getting some of the voices, one unique voice in particular, who stopped by the breakfast station here at KGNU. It's 4700 Walnut Street, just past the Foothills overpass if you're coming east on Walnut. And we'll be here with food and coffee and fellowship for another half hour or so if you'd like to swing by on your bike or your feet. So thanks to everybody for making Bike to Work Day a reality here at KGNU. From the excitement of that to the calming effects of gardening now, we have a panel of expert gardeners in the studio, and we would love to hear your questions, hear your comments, tell us how your garden is doing. We're so pleased to have Eve Reshetnik-Bronner and Michael Bronner from Harlequin's Gardens in North Boulder with us, longtime local business, longtime supporters of KGNU. It's great to see you both. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Good morning.
And also Aaron Michael, a voice you might have heard in recent weeks on KGNU for a couple of short interviews that we did with Aaron about pollinator gardens and edible gardens. His business is Earth Love Gardens. Aaron, it's great to see you again as well.
It's great to see you.
Well, let's start before we turn to listener questions with just kind of an overview of what you were thinking going into this gardening season after a pretty hard winter, Michael. Let me start with you. You know, a lot of snow, a lot of freezing. What's on the mind of an expert gardener when we come out of that kind of a winter?
Well, Colorado's famous for unpredictable winters, and this past one, we had three below zero events. One 20 below or so at the end of December, one 10 below at the end of January, and another 10 below at the end of February, which is pretty late for below zero. And so these together have added up to some kind of harsh conditions, especially for woody plants. And we're seeing quite a bit of dead and very slow to come out growth on woody plants. And so we've been getting a lot of questions about that at Harlequin's. When should we start pruning, cutting out this this woody material that has not leafed? And so we've been telling them pretty much hold off as long as possible until perhaps now to see if things are really dead. And so one of the ways of telling if it's really dead is to scratch the bark with your fingernail, and if it's green underneath, then there's still hope. And if it's brown underneath, or if the bark is wrinkled, then that branch at least is dead, and you can cut it back to the live.
Now, what is a woody plant?
So a woody plant is anything like a tree or a shrub that that doesn't normally die back, but holds its form all winter.
So we have in our front yard a honeysuckle that we planted probably 25 years ago or close to it, and it grew up the front porch, and it grew under the porch and had its own thing happening on the other side of the porch. And it really, there's very few leaves on it now. And we were wondering, well, 20, 25 years, maybe it's just, you know, had its run and we should rip it out because there's very few leaves at this point. What do you think? Anybody? Eve, what do you think about that honeysuckle?
Well, I had the same experience with one of my honeysuckles. Some of the others that I have are hardier. They're honeysuckle vines, not shrubs. And I, for example, my Hall's honeysuckle, a really fragrant one, has died to the ground, and it's also been in about 25 years. But it is coming up from the base. Another one I have is not coming up from the base, but it does have some foliage sporadically, you know, up the stems. And I'm going to give that one another year before I cut it all the way down. So see how big a comeback it can make this year. And I'm going to help it along with some fertilizer and some organic fertilizer and some compost tea to just give it its best chance of reviving its vitality.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll give mine another year based on that. Folks, if you'd like to pose a question to our gardeners this morning, our number is 303-442-4242. That's 303-442-4242. Or you can pose your question by email. That's dj@kgnu.org, letter D, letter J, dj@kgnu.org. You used a term there that I also not familiar with, compost tea. What is that? Is that like liquid compost is my guess? I don't
know. I'm going to let Michael take this one.
Well, compost tea is kind of as variable as compost. So compost, of course, is an organic material that is generally made from our garden wastes, is basically the action of soil biology, bacteria and beneficial fungi that break down this raw organic matter into a more usable form that's more available to plants, and that's the compost. And then we can take that compost, a small amount of that, and put it in a barrel of water that is being oxygenated with an air pump, and then add some nutrients to that, generally kelp and minerals, sometimes a few other things that then is oxygenated for 24 to 36 of a 48-hour period to produce this tea, which has both nutrients, but it's really basically a biological stimulant, a biological support for the plants. So it's like compost. It doesn't seem like it should have that much of an effect, but people report that it has a lot of effect.
Aaron Michael from Earth Love Gardens, do you use that compost tea?
Yes, and especially for people that want a simple solution to replenish their gardens, it's best not to use chemical fertilizers. They can buy or make their own compost tea rather easily, and it's a very potent nutrient that is organic, and like Michael says, it works really well.
We're here with Aaron Michael from Earth Love Gardens, Eve Reshetnik-Bronner, and Michael Bronner from Harlequin's Gardens. If you have a question, I want to tell us how your garden is doing or pose a question to our expert gardeners, the number is 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242, or email us at dj@kgnu.org. So I have a few tomato plants in pots, and the leaves are turning yellow. And I should start by saying I know nothing about gardening. You know, I enjoy the occasional, you know, we have a lovely group of plants in the front that my wife takes care of. And I thought I would like to have some tomatoes. So I got some starters in pots, and there's a few tomatoes on the vine now, but there's also a lot of yellow leaves, and I never know, is that too much water, too little water? I mean, we had all that rain and all that hail, and they seem to have survived, but they don't look all that healthy. So what does this mean? Eve?
I think I may need to know a little bit more, but if the yellowing leaves are at the bottom of the plant, or the lowest leaves on the stem,
typically yes,
then I would not worry too much. If you start seeing little things like little brown spots amongst the yellow, then you may have a fungal disease problem. But just yellowing leaves, I also don't know how big your plant is at this point, but as the plant grows, it's pretty normal for the lowest leaves to kind of slough off. They turn yellow first. I wouldn't worry yet.
Okay.
There are a couple other things about yellow leaves. Sometimes yellow is an indication of lack of nitrogen. And it's very common for us to have the lack of nitrogen in our plants, both because our soils are generally low, both in nitrogen and in organic matter, but also because in containers, you're using potting soil, and potting soils are as variable as compost. And a lot of times, if you buy a commercial grade potting soil, that is actually designed to be used with chemical fertilizers, and so it has essentially no nutrients in it. And so if that's all that you have, then it's quite possible that your plant is lacking in nitrogen or other nutrients, and probably a good idea to give it an organic fertilizer.
Okay. If the yellow leaves do have the brown spots, which may be a sign of a fungal infection, I think you said, Eve, is that a result of too much water or too little, or just it just happened? Like, why does that?
It can be a result of overwatering. Tomatoes really like to have a consistent amount of water every day. I think that where am I going here?
Yeah. To that was, should I pull them off, the yellow leaves, or just leave them and they'll wither
you
and
can.
Die?
Okay. You can.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because without the, they're not able to photosynthesize.
Okay. Mm. Aaron, any additional tips for me on tomatoes? Anybody else?
Keep the faith. Keep watering them. Do what you need to do to allow them to keep growing.
Definitely you need to keep them fertilized with organic fertilizers, which are slow release. They're not a big hit all at once. And fertilizers can be more rapidly absorbed if you feel the need is urgent by spraying with a solution of a liquid organic fertilizer.
The compost tea that Michael referred to.
Compost tea, but also things like fish and seaweed fertilizer will actually enter the leaves, as a foliar spray. And give the nutrition a little quicker than applying something in the soil, scratching something into the soil that's a granular fertilizer.
So I would go to a gardening place and say I want fish and seaweed fertilizer, and they'd know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And as long as we're talking about tomatoes, once you've got some fruit setting, which I think you said you had a couple of tomatoes already formed. You're going to want to switch the emphasis of your fertilizer to give more support to flowering and fruiting. So there's I'm going to let Michael talk about the chemical balance.
Okay, but we're trying to support flowering and fruiting because we've actually seen some fruit.
Not just foliar growth.
Yeah.
And stems. So
in the beginning of the season, you're wanting to encourage vegetative growth. You want leaves and stems, and you want the plant to get bigger. The more leaves, the more capacity the plant is going to have for photosynthesis, which then helps it to grow and perform all of the other functions. But then once it starts moving into the sexual phase of producing flowers and fruit, then you want to support more of that. If you just keep pumping nitrogen into the plant, you might get very big, but then have very little fruit. So then you want to back off on the nitrogen and start giving some fertilizers that are a little more phosphorus and potassium.
And is that fish and seaweed one an example of that?
Fish and seaweed is a very general fertilizer, which will kind of give a balance. And if it's a lot of fish, then that's more of the nitrogen. So, but there are fertilizers, fish and seaweed fertilizers, that have a balance that's more towards the phosphorus and potassium.
We're at 303-442-4242. That's 303-442-4242 if you'd like to join our conversation. Or if email is easier, send it to DJ, letter D, letter J, DJ at KGNU.org, like Sherry did. And Sherry's question is related to tomatoes. There are many small black winged insects on the leaves and stems. Any idea on what they are and an organic solution to remove them? Anybody? Small black winged insects on the leaves and stems of her tomato plants.
Sounds like aphids to me.
Aphids?
Aphids come in a lot of different colors. A lot of them are green, but they also can be black. And I wouldn't be too worried about them. Aphids are the favorite food of so many beneficial insects, predatory insects. And if you get rid of all the aphids before you give the beneficials a chance, then you're never going to have a good population of beneficials there to help you.
Aaron, what are we talking about, like beneficial insects?
Beneficial insects are insects that help your garden and the environment. Let's say just a non-beneficial insect would be, say, the Japanese beetles. But insects, are part of the ecosystem, so we want to support them, and in turn, they support our gardens.
So when should Sherry do something? Like if she starts seeing the leaves being eaten, or what's the, like, you're saying leave them if they're aphids, but when is it cause for alarm?
So in terms of what they call integrated pest management, there's a sort of system that we follow, and the first rule is that if there's no more than 10% damage, don't do anything, because that provides you're leaving the pests on the plants to provide food for the beneficial insects, which will then come when they smell the pests, and then they will know that there's food in that area, and they'll lay their eggs in your garden, and they'll be there for the next year. So, but if there's more than 10% damage, then use a non-toxic pesticide, which something like a safer soap or a horticultural oil or neem, or there's other things as well, which will either kill the pest or make the plant distasteful and repel the pests. With aphids, one of the quickest things to do is just spray it with a strong stream of water. That might knock off 50 to 75% of the aphids and still leave a few for the beneficial insects.
Well, I have to add a little aphid story. About 8 or 10 days ago, I discovered that my current bush, all the terminal, you know, the growth tips all over, were encrusted with aphids. There was a thick coating of them on every one of those. And then I looked again, a moment later, and saw that there were ladybug larvae on the plant, and they were not moving at that point. They were just getting started. And I came back a week later, and there was not an aphid left on the whole bush. And I know who did the work.
Yeah. So you waited for the beneficial insect, in this case the ladybug, to mature and eat the aphids. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, it's the larvae the mature beetle that we all recognize is does eat aphids, but the larvae are way faster.
Mm-hmm. By the way, the ladybug larvae are they look like little yellow and black alligators. They don't look at all like a ladybug.
Orange and black.
Oh, good to know. Aaron Michael.
And regarding the aphids, if you don't have enough ladybugs and they're going to town on, say, your milkweed, and you don't have reinforcements quick enough coming in for the ladybugs, going to your bathroom, getting a piece of toilet paper, wetting it, and cleaning off the leaves of the aphids is a very effective strategy to keep your plant healthy.
Okay, well, Sherry, if those are aphids, there's some tips for you. Stephen has written in asking, is it a good idea to add charred wood to garden soil, also known, I think, as biochar? Anybody want to weigh in on that? He's asking about adding biochar to garden soil.
So biochar is wood that has been heated without much oxygen so that it doesn't burn up completely and it leaves this carbon behind. And what is so distinctive about biochar is that it has an enormous number of surface area contacts, which then can be habitat for beneficial fungi and bacteria. So this is carbon, and we generally think of, oh, fertility, that must mean nitrogen. But in fact, carbon is a building block of life, and that's more and more gardeners are thinking about how to get carbon into our soils, especially stuff like compost is a carbon product. And by putting carbon into the soil, we're actually sequestering carbon and keeping it from going into carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But in this case, the idea of using biochar is not in itself enough. That people talk about charging biochar with a fertilizer that then helps that whole process. The fertilizer then becomes stored in all of these little pockets in the biochar. And then microorganisms can use both the fertilizer and the carbon to create fertility.
So for Stephen, biochar in and of itself, maybe not all that useful, but if it's combined with fertilizer, did I hear you correctly, it can be a potential good thing for your garden soil?
Yeah, anytime that you put carbon into the soil, the microorganisms immediately go after carbon as food, and in order for them to make that into food, they have to combine that carbon with nitrogen. And if they take the nitrogen from the soil, then maybe your tomatoes will turn yellow from lack of nitrogen. But if you add a fertilizer to the biochar, then you don't have that problem.
That's Michael Bronner from Harlequin's Gardens. Aaron Michael from Earth Love Gardens, anything to add on biochar? Nope. And let me remind folks that they're listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder and KGNU 1390 Denver. It's 9 o'clock. We've got about another half hour with our expert gardeners in studio. If you'd like to pose a question or make a comment, the phone number is 303-442-4242. The email is dj@kgnu.org, and we do have several questions on the email. Here's one from Niall. Little holes in the kale leaves? Question mark. Little holes in the kale leaves? In raised bed. Must be a pest? It's like a haiku from Niall about the holes in the kale leaves. Okay. Eve.
The little holes are almost certainly the result of flea beetles. And probably the best short-term solution is to get some diatomaceous earth and sprinkle that on the plants when they're dry, and you know, try not to get it wet after you've applied it. And I think Michael's a better one to explain exactly what diatomaceous earth is, but it's made of tiny little microscopic diatoms and from the sea, and they are, you know, on a microscopic level, very abrasive to insects.
Okay.
And so the long-term solution is to have as much plant diversity around your garden, around your vegetable, and within your vegetable garden, so that you are providing a big smorgasbord for beneficial insects. And so a lot of the, especially the very small flowered plants like sweet alyssum, yarrow, things that are in the parsley family. I always let my parsleys go in their second year, go to flower and then to seed.
And you do that because the insects like them?
Because, yeah, especially the really, the flowers that are made up of little tiny florets are most attractive to parasitic wasps and all kinds of other beneficial insects. So when you've built that population up, when the beneficial insects know this is a good place to live, then you're going to have a lot less pests.
And one of the things I would add about a diatomaceous earth is that it is an example of a non-toxic pesticide. But it is, because of the sharp particles, it's not something that you want to breathe. So often I will suggest to people, especially with flea beetles, which are hard to control. Beetles in general are much harder to control than soft-bodied insects like aphids and caterpillars. With flea beetles, sometimes I would suggest to spray the plant with something like neem, and then while it's still damp, to sprinkle the diatomaceous earth on it so it sticks. And to do that maybe every day or every other day for a couple times in order to really present a barrier to let the flea beetles know this is not a good place to live.
And I also want to add that I've heard that planting onions and garlic in your bed can help repel non-beneficial insects. And I also want to say, give a shout out to Niall, because I recognize him. He's one of our clients. We build his raised beds.
And also, just know that they may come in more than one wave per season, but flea beetles are only around for like up to 2 weeks at a time.
Okay, so...
And there are different kinds of flea beetles, and some of them are going to go after... some of them are specific to crops like kale and broccoli in that plant family, the cabbage family. Some of them are specific to plants in the tomato family. This is tomatoes, eggplants, and peppers, based mostly, and tomatillas, and ground cherries. There is another strain that is a generalist and can go after all of the above. So.
You mentioned a spray called neem, Michael. What is that?
So neem is a tree in that's often from India, and it produces this oil. And neem is another example of a non-toxic pesticide. In fact, for the last 15 years or so, I've been using a neem toothpaste. But neem functions in a couple different ways. One is that it will actually, because it's an oil and it has this, the active ingredient is azadirachtin. And by the way, if you're getting neem, you should make sure that it has that active ingredient, because there are neem products where the azadirachtin has been taken out and sold separately, and then all you're getting is the oil. But neem with azadirachtin acts both by suffocating the insect as an oil, but also it acts by interrupting the developmental process of moving from one stage of development to another. So it's not a very nice thing to do, but the insect will then not be able to outgrow its exoskeleton, and then it will die. But this is a non-toxic approach.
Yeah, so apply the neem with azadirachtin and then the diatomaceous earth on the kale. That's okay. Nile, that's what you're doing to get rid of those pests on your kale. Let's take another email question. This is from Diane. There are few bees in my area. Is there a way to pollinate a potted tomato plant or a potted zucchini? Eve?
Okay. Let's talk about the tomato plants first. Tomatoes are not bee pollinated. In fact, they are self-pollinating.
What does that mean?
That means that the structure of the flower is designed so that the sexual parts actually are pollinating the pollen is getting onto the stigma before the flower even opens. So they are self-pollinating. In fact, peppers and larger flowered tomatoes, there are some old varieties of tomatoes that have especially large flowers, are also pollinated by just vibration, either the vibration of a bumblebee or the vibration of the wind. You know, that's caused by the wind.
What if I played music and this with the sonic vibrations?
This I don't know. I can't answer that, Sam. Right. Squash, there are actually specific bees that are called squash bees that do visit those flowers. If you're only looking at honeybees, and you're not seeing many honeybees in your garden, know that there are other native bees that are smaller than honeybees that are out there, and they probably are going to do the work for you. So I don't think you're going to have any problem with the tomatoes getting pollinated. The squash can be a little tricky earlier in its season, Sometimes the balance of female and male flowers on the plant or plants is not such that they're open at the same time and able to have a pollen transfer happen. But usually once things get going, the plant's a little bigger and it's got more flowers going at once. And also, hopefully you have multiple plants of the same thing. They can start really effectively being pollinated. If you really think that you don't have helpers out there, you can hand pollinate. If you learn to recognize what's a male flower and what's a female flower, and you get the male flowers are going to have multiple stamens with anthers on them that have this powdery pollen on them. And you can take a Q-tip and transfer that pollen onto the single stigma that is in the middle of a female flower. The female flowers have, you can also tell because at the base of the flower, look on the outside of the flower, you will find a little miniature start of the shape of the squash that you're growing, or cucumber, or melon. And
that's how
how you tell it's a female flower. Oh, it's got the ovary already started.
Oh, that's so cool. So Diane could try a little manual pollination, but also the point is there are so many different kinds of bees, even though you're not seeing honeybees, the beneficial ones, Aaron Michael, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, might be already around and you don't know it.
Right, yeah, and it's always great to plant more native plants that support these beneficial pollinators. Like Harlequin Gardens is great place to get them, and things like our native yarrow and chocolate flower and bee balm and milkweed, and the list goes on and on, is both great for your garden and also for our ecosystem.
Well, excellent. Let's get to a few more email questions. We are at dj@kgnu.org, dj@kgnu.org, or if you'd like to join us by phone, we're always happy to hear your voice. That's 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242. Okay, this is Kate writing in. There are many small holes in my tomato plant leaves. Should I spray? Also, my plants so far are not thick. How do I get them fuller? My plants are about 16 inches tall, so she's concerned that they're not thick, they're 16 inches tall, and they have holes in the leaves. Initial thoughts? Anybody?
Well, it sounds again like probably flea beetles. And so what we were saying before about how to deal with flea beetles apply here. As far as thickening up the plant, it may be that there's just not enough nutrition generally to produce enough growth to thicken it up. And so just one overview about pests in general, relating to flea beetles in particular, is that pests, that plants have not been able to run away from their pests. They're rooted to the ground, and so they have developed over millions of years the capacity to defend themselves chemically. And so the various chemicals, some of the chemicals make themselves indigestible, some are have a repellent quality, some are actually even poisonous. But through this chemical defense system, the plants have been able to exist in the wild without human intervention. But in our gardens, where we're using a soil that often is not very high in biological activity, most of the soils that we buy in bags are not very rich in biological activity. that we can support that chemical defense system nutritionally. And so that's both by having carbon in the soil to provide for the plants and also various other nutrients that then the biology in the soil can digest and make available to the plants.
Let's take another email question here. This is from Eric. Hello, gardeners. Eric writes, our North Boulder plum trees have been producing large purple plums in recent years, but due to freeze damage last winter, they did not leaf out at all this spring. Now they're producing sucker shoots. Can these trees be saved, or should we replant? So the sounds like the hard winter impacted the plum trees, and I'm wondering if they should save them or replant them. What do you think, Michael Bronner?
Well, we've seen a lot of damage. And in fact, some peach trees have died completely. Some plums have died completely. And this has been a fairly common thing to see, that there are no leaves on the older branches, but that we're getting shoots coming from either the lower part of the trunks or actually just from the ground. So if this is a plum tree that is a named variety that you bought, then if the shoots are coming from the ground, you've lost the named variety, and what's coming from the ground is the rootstock. So almost all fruit trees are grafted, so that we take a known variety and graft it into a wild variety that has a strong, cold hardy roots system, and then that. Then we cut off the wild part and just keep the domesticated part. But if the freeze kills it completely to the ground and what comes up from the ground, all these shoots, that's not the variety that you bought. That's a wild plum. And maybe that's okay. Maybe it'll still make plums. Maybe they won't be that good. And so if it's peach, oftentimes a peach tree can be saved, because a lot of peaches actually can be grown from pits, unlike apples, which can't. If you grow an apple from an apple seed, you have no idea what you're going to get, and often it's not that good.
Let me ask, he's saying they didn't leaf out at all, and he's got the sucker shoots. Should he give it another year, or in the case of this plum tree, is it done?
Well, like I said, if it's a named variety and there are no shoots coming out of the stems themselves, it's all coming out of the ground, then he gets to decide whether he wants to have a wild plum or if he wants to just take that out and start over again.
Got it.
But if you do want to keep it, the basic idea is that when you have 20 shoots coming out of the ground, that's not going to make a good tree. So you're going to have to limit the number of shoots in order to re-educate it as a tree. So you might start off by making 20 shoots into three, and then over the next couple years, limiting that to one.
Okay, now here's another email question from Paul. He sent photos, which I will try to open, and can you see that? And I'll swing mine over. He's wondering if this tree can be saved.
What is it?
Let me check and see if he says what kind of tree it is. It looks like it's leafing out in some places, but a lot of dead branches.
I can answer
no,
that.
Yeah, he doesn't identify the type of tree. Here's another photo of it. That's useful.
Oh yeah. Well, that looks like an arborvita, maybe.
Okay. Can the arborvita be saved?
Well, I've seen a lot of that this year, and if the alternative is to just cut it to the ground and start over, then you might just as well leave it and wait and see. I have a couple trees of my at the nursery that look similar, not quite that bad, but similar, and I'm waiting. At some point, if I've discovered that the branches are actually dead, I'll start removing the dead, and hopefully the rest of the tree will survive. But if it's 9/10 brown,
and that's kind of what this one looks like.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
It may not be savable, but I have seen trees even skip a whole year before releafing. So, like I said, if the alternative is just to cut it to the ground, you might just as well wait and see.
Okay. Aaron or Eve, anything to add to that? Nope. Okay. Oh, Aaron, go ahead.
And I do tend to see that a lot of arborvitas die. They have to be replanted a lot. But the fact that I see a good amount of green in there gives me hope that your tree has hope. So, as Michael says, yeah, keep watching it continue to grow more green.
We're at 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242. If you'd like to join in via phone, if you'd like to ask a question by email, that's DJ, letter D, letter J, DJ at KGNU.org. And here's one from Leslie: horned worms on tomatoes. Is there a natural, healthy way to keep them off the tomato plants, the horned worms? Who would like to take that? Eve.
What I like to do is pull them off and feed them to the birds.
Manual extraction via your fingers?
Is it? Yes.
Okay.
But if you want to use a product, once you know that they're out there, you can spray with a product called BT, which is short for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacteria that I think it stops their ability to feed. And if they eat leaves that are that have been sprayed with BT, they very quickly stop feeding and fall off and die. You want to be careful about your use of BT, that you're only putting it on plants and parts of plants that are not going to be visited by other, you know, by butterflies or you know, butterfly caterpillars.
And that's because that would hurt them, or I'm not
yes,
sure.
Yeah. Yes, you know, all of the Lepidoptera, all of the caterpillar realm would be affected by it.
So BT is another example of a non-toxic pesticide. It's toxic to these caterpillars that eat it, but it's not toxic to anything else. It's very specific, and that's one of the reasons why it's good and safe to use.
Let me just check the email one more time. DJ at KGNU.org is the number. Sorry, the email address. The number is 303-442-4242. No, I don't see any questions. Let me ask you, pose a really broad one to all of you. And I know, even Michael, you've been doing this for some years. Have you observed with global climate disruption, what has been the impact for gardeners in our part of the world?
Well, for one thing, it's hard to tell. Colorado has always been quite volatile in its temperatures and climate changing. I would say that the best response to either Colorado's normal erratic conditions or climate change, whichever happens to be occurring, that the best response is to be planting plants that are well adapted to Colorado conditions. Plants that like our alkaline conditions, plants that can handle rapid temperature changes, plants that are natives and have been around here for thousands of millions of years and that have adapted over that period of time to difficult conditions. And also how we grow our plants conditions them to be more or less capable of handling climate change and other changes. So, for example, chemical fertilizers, which make plants grow very rapidly, we have been trained over the last 50 years to use these products made from petroleum that have big growth responses. You know, we put chemical fertilizers on our lawns and they rapidly jump up and are green, and we think, wow, that was really successful. But what we're not seeing is that that soft growth is actually very attractive to fungal diseases and pest problems, and that chemical fertilizers do not contain the micronutrients that are so important for plants to develop their own immune systems. So one of the things that people don't seem to be very aware of is how important minerals are and micronutrients are beyond just the NPK, and that is one of the things that, as I had mentioned before, that when we can give those kind of nutrients to our plants, that it gives them the abilities to develop their own defense systems and just be stronger plants. And this also translates into higher nutritional value. It's an interesting thing that what the plants use for their defense is also what, when we eat it, becomes helpful in our own immune systems.
Oh, didn't know that. Aaron Michael from Earth Love Gardens, as we wrap up, anything to add to Michael's perspective on just making a healthy garden in a time and a place that can be difficult due to the extremes?
Yeah, I think it rolls back to the first things we were talking about. Add compost tea to your garden, going beyond the NPK. You know, this will add some beneficial nutrients. Use less store-bought chemical additives to your garden. We want to go back to the old ways that we used to do things that kept us alive since the beginning of creation. And, you know, this movement in the past, you know, over 50 years of commercializing our food source, our food sources, you know, adding pesticides to non-native grasses. These are non-natural, unsustainable practices that are really taking a toll on our earth. So we want our future to look towards our past because they worked. So we want to do things that connect us with the earth, things that come from the earth naturally. And these things that nature provides are well and abundant to keep us going and keep us growing nutritious, delicious food and keeping a strong, healthy, regenerative society going.
Aaron Michael from Earth Love Gardens. People can find out more information online, I'm assuming?
Yes. My website is www.earthlovegardens.com.
Earthlovegardens.com. Michael Bronner, Eve Reshetnik-Bronner, it's great to see you both again. Harlequin's Gardens is in North Boulder. Do you have an online presence, or you want people to just
yes,
go there?
We do. Okay. We're at harlequinsgardens.com, and it's HARLEQUINS, garden with an S at the end, .com. And we have a weekly, generally weekly, e-newsletter that you can subscribe to on our website.
Harlequin's Gardens.
HarlequinsGardens.com.
Right. And I just have one further thing to say, which is that if people have questions about problems, either fungal diseases or insect problems, that they can contact the Cooperative Extension Service in Longmont. They can actually take samples there Mondays and Thursdays, 9 to 1, or they can call the Master Gardeners, to get answers to their questions in between time.
Yes, great state and county program, the Cooperative Extension Service. Thank you for that. Michael, Eve, Aaron, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with our listeners this morning. Thanks to everybody who emailed. It's 9:30 at listener-supported KGNU, the Morning Sound Alternative, coming your way after these announcements.